Good evening and welcome, everyone. I am delighted to welcome you into a new year, to the sounding of a new do for the new year, a new beginning with our shared intention for the fullness of the human possibility in and as Christ. And we do so this week of Mr. Gurdjieff's birthday, which is January 13th. Last week, we noted in the introduction to the Journey School class, in the preface to Mr. Gurdjieff's epic myth, Beelzebub Tales to his grandson, he offers a big wish for anyone who is studying his writings to form their own judgment as to their truth, the truth that was particular to one's own self. And he concludes by saying, "Only then can my hope be actualized, that according to your understanding, you will obtain the specific benefit for you, which I anticipate and which I wish for you with all my being." So let us know that this school, these classes, and all offerings have a big wish with all of our being for each of us, that we will be able to actualize what is ours, a theophany of Christ through these offerings. And I'm going to just pause for a moment and turn off my video in order to, I hope, bring it back to clarity. Magic. So here we are, magic. So the Christ candle is lit as a symbol of this light that was and is always with us and within us as the essential being. And we call upon the conscious circle of humanity to gather with us this evening and inform us. We join with Mr. Gurdjieff that when beginning anything new, we are to unfailingly pronounce in the name of the Father and of the Son and in the name of the Holy Spirit. Another of our teachers, Bernadette Roberts, might express the sacred prayer of intention in this way. In the name of God transcendent, God omnipresent, God immanent, the Holy Living Trinity. Amen. Thus we begin anew. I might mention, as we did last week, that our work is twofold. One, as it is said, is on the side of knowledge. And here we not only study teachings of theology and spirituality, but we also study science and cosmology and anthropology, psychology, and philosophy. On the side of being, we have silence and prayer and devotion, service, the application of work ideas in three lines of work. We practice and we try to embody what it is that we're learning. This is not an academic theological school of ideas only. It is a practicum in life, and that is its intention. So, as is our custom for these evenings, we remember one of our teachers who have gone before us, opened the door, and shown us the way. In addition to their vast knowledge by virtue of their being, they have released a great deal of energy into the world and directly to us personally. We owe them a great deal for this. Tonight, we do honor the life and work of Mr. Gurdjieff, and we honor the 100th anniversary of when he first came to the United States. We stand in his direct lineage through our own teachers. You might say that we are the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of Mr. Gurdjieff, so to speak. Our opening reflection comes from his third and final book in his All and Everything series. It is entitled, Life is Real Only Then When I Am. The purpose of this book, he stated in his own words, were to assist the arising in the mentation and in the feelings of the reader of a veritable, non-fantastic representation, not that of the illusory world, which he now perceives, but of the world existing in its reality. A big statement on his part. Here is what he said as a paragraph out of that book. Only one, by his or her intentional efforts, obtains the arising in oneself of data for the engendering of impulses sacred for man. Only such a one, when he consciously says, I am, he really is. I can, he really can. I wish, he really wishes. When I wish, I feel with my whole being that I wish and can wish. This does not mean that I want, that I need, that I like, or lastly, that I desire. No, I wish. I never like, never want. I do not desire anything, and I do not need anything. All of this is slavery. If I wish something, I must like it, even if I do not like it. I can wish to like, because I can. I wish. I feel with my whole body that I wish. I wish, because I can wish. I wish because I can wish. May it be so for us that we wish to abide in the fullness of our life. A precious human life. Amen. So taking in the profundity of this message, we now prepare ourselves. What each of us brings matters. How we come matters. How we participate matters. So we place ourselves here, now, with intention and imminent trust and receptivity to the influences coming from the circle of conscious humanity. And we prepare to receive them. With back upright, heart open, in directed attention, body relaxed, noticing and then letting go of all tension, constriction, resistance. Open now. We breathe in deeply all every most hidden part of our being. All being. Everything. Everything that passed through us this day. Our world today. Everything. Everything that hurt, that confused, that created fear, that brought heaviness, that left us feeling powerless, less than, more than, everything. Everything that uplifted, that loved, that brought joy, all affirming, all denying. And we hold it as offering reconciled, as food for being. We lift it and ask that it all be transubstantiated in our being as whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved of God. We do this on behalf of everyone and everything. And we breathe out this healing light into the world, all worlds. I hand over all complexities. I hand over all plans. I hand over all anxieties and small fears of my heart. I yield to the divine human life. I am here. I am. I wish. I can work. I stand unencumbered before God and one another. Lord, have mercy. And so it is. So now we enter into our time of Lectio Divina. And we're going to share a passage from today's email. It will be read three times with a silent pause in between each reading. Unknown and yet well known, the God of mystery is at the same time uniquely close to us, filling all things, present everywhere around us and within us. The Holy Living Trinity, and present not merely as an atmosphere or a nameless force, but in a personal way. The God who is infinitely beyond our understanding reveals God's self to us as person, calls us each by our name, and we answer in a relationship of love. God is both further from us and nearer to us than anything else. And we find paradoxically that these two poles do not cancel one another out. On the contrary, the more we are attracted to the one pole, the more vividly we become aware of the other at the same time. Abraham journeys from his familiar home into an unknown country. Moses progresses from light into darkness. And so it proves to be for each one who follows the spiritual way. We go out from the known to the unknown, from light into darkness. We go forward from the light of partial knowledge into a greater knowledge, which is so much more profound that it can only be described as the darkness of unknowing. We begin to realize how little we understand. We see that it is not the task of Christianity to provide easy answers to every question, but to make us progressively aware of a mystery. God is not so much the object of our knowledge as the cause of our wonder. And so it becomes that the eye of faith is the seeing eye that penetrates the senses and events and sees God in everything. Unknown and yet well known. The God of mystery is at the same time uniquely close to us, filling all things, present everywhere around us and within us, the Holy Living Trinity, and present not merely as an atmosphere or nameless force, but in a personal way. The God who is infinitely beyond our understanding reveals God's self to us as person, calls us each by our name, and we answer in a relationship of love. God is both further from us and nearer to us than anything else, and we find paradoxically that these two poles do not cancel one another out. On the contrary, the more we are attracted to the one pole, the more vividly we become aware of the other at the same time. Abraham journeys from his familiar home into an unknown country. Moses progresses from light into darkness. And so it proves to be for each one who follows the spiritual way. We go out from the known to the unknown, from light into darkness. We go forward from the light of partial knowledge into a greater knowledge, which is so much more profound that it can only be described as the darkness of unknowing. We begin to realize how little we understand. We see that it is not the task of Christianity to provide easy answers to every question, but to make us progressively aware of a mystery. God is not so much the object of our knowledge as the cause of our wonder. And so it becomes that the eye of God is the seeing eye that penetrates the senses and events and sees God in everything. Amen. Because our passage is long tonight, we will just read it twice. I invite you to share with us what you received from taking in and ingesting this passage, or perhaps from the image that spoke to you. Yes, Billy, welcome. Good evening.
Good evening, Mary Ann and everybody. Something that stood out for me in this that I think I'm going to be pondering for a long time is that God's self revealed as a person or as person. I have always had trouble with the idea that we had a personal relationship with God. I've never been able to feel it, comprehend it, wrap my head around it, understand it, or anything. But that line about God's self as person gave me a new way to look at it. And I don't still know that I understand it. It's such a mystery, no matter how you look at it.
Yes.
But I have always understood that God is within each and every sentient being, and certainly humans. And I can kind of get that. I can get that because I do have personal relationships with people. So maybe that just gets expanded a little bit. It's not just the people who are in my life on a regular basis, but perhaps people I've never met, perhaps
yes.
People who are on the street, perhaps someone I don't like or have trouble with. anyway, it's given me something to work with that maybe I can actually get to a place of understanding this idea of having a personal relationship with God.
May it be so. Watch what you wish for.
I know that's very dangerous.
Yes, it is. Exciting. Thank you. Rodney, good evening.
Hey, Marianne. And hi, everybody. Good to see everybody again. This topic just seems, it just feels perfect for this time.
Yes.
What I heard was these two poles do not cancel each other out. And that seems to be something that seems to be growing more and more inside of me. Just to know or in my being, starting to feel God's infinite love and infinite power and creativity, just the infinity of it all. But then yet that love and that energy shines down through every cell in my body. And so I can feel it personally as well. The prayer that I thought was so perfect from Bernadette, because that just kind of explains how God is both transcendent and immanent as well.
Indeed.
And the reading from Mr. Gurdjieff about wish just made me, there's a prayer that I say every day, probably several times a day. It comes from a CCH chant that we do. And it's a wish that I know you more, that I love you more, and that I serve you, wish that I serve you more. Thank you.
Thank you, Rodney. Thank you. It's good to be back with you again in this way.
Love you, Marianne.
Yes, I love you, Rodney. It says Rick, but I believe it's Jeannie.
Yes, my husband used my computer. Kind of on the heels of, and hello, everyone. On the heels of Rodney's expression of Bernadette's prayer, I saw in the image the intimacy of the two people in the very middle, the small, and then the halo around the earth image or whatever. So the intimacy and the vastness, so the transcendence and the immanence. And the other line was progressively aware of a mystery. And certainly that is kind of the touchstone of our diving into this theme this year.
Yes, that's right. The whole year.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeannie. Welcome. Mm-hmm. It's good to be with you. So if you're very, very fast, I don't know, 200 hour YTT, would you like to introduce us to your name? And then Grady, if you're both very fast or brief. Oh, it's Ray.
It's Ray. Yeah,
it's Ray and Whitney.
The name, couldn't do it. I'll be brief. What I heard was similar to Billy, the God as person, the first part. And so it made me think about the development of the individual. And in the end of the passage, it mentioned Christianity not giving any easy answers. And so the relationship with God can be fully experienced, not in the realm of the intellect, but it has to land down in the realm of instinct, because instinctual development is, you know, part of human development. And the child is, you know, developing his personality, not in a conscious way, but being led by something.
Yes.
And so it made me think about the biblical passage about, in order to enter the kingdom of heaven, one must be like a child.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Ray. And good evening, Whitney. So lastly, Grady, welcome.
Thank you. What came up for me quickly is unknowing. The word unknowing is very harmonic for me.
Mm-hmm.
As if I would kind of, as a picture of a cushion for my meditation, if you will. So that comes out of a familiarity with the cloud of unknowing.
Yes.
As the very basis of, or, you know, certainly listening, reading Meister Eckhart in terms of being in touch with the ground and sitting with what you don't know and not bringing in what you think you know.
Amen. Thank you, Grady, and welcome. Well, tonight I am delighted that once again this year, our beloved friend, Michael Begeman, is going to launch us on our journey into unknowing for the year, and be leading us through knowledge and mystery at the center of all being. So welcome, Michael. Do you have something to share with us, perhaps? A word or two? What have you discovered?
You are not nearly that lucky.
Yes.
I was smiling when Grady was sharing and looking at the stack of books that I have here that I was using to prepare tonight. We have Thomas's Reflections on the Unknowable. We have Meister Eckhart, from whom God hid nothing. We have Abraham Joshua Heschel's I asked for wonder. We have the cloud of unknowing and a couple of other things.
So you're going to summarize them for us. Is that it?
God willing.
God willing. If anyone can do it, I know you can. Bless Thanks. You.
So I'll share my screen here. So knowledge and mystery at the center of all being, seeing through a glass darkly. It's an interesting topic. Knowledge and mystery. These things are that word. You know the word. When we grasp onto knowledge, then mystery disappears. And when we sit with mystery, then the unknown may present itself to us. But we have to be very gentle and very receptive to approach the mystery and to have a relationship with it. There is a roadmap that we have for this evening, and it's exploring knowledge and mystery in three different contexts. One is knowledge and mystery about God, knowledge and mystery about the universe, and knowledge and mystery about ourselves. So we're going to take three successive walks through the topic of knowledge and mystery using these three lenses as examples or as things to provoke some thought. And I begin with a quote from Socrates: "All that we know is that nothing can be known." So I have a handful of things to say tonight, but I would preface it with, take it all lightly, that the things that I have learned and the things that I believe, I hold very provisionally. And whatever I think is truth today, I am willing to be shown that, oh, there is something even more to know than that. So there is another model that we're going to be using throughout these three movements tonight. It's a model that I learned in a workshop 25, 30 years ago or so. And it's been very handy for me. And that is, the knowledge falls into three buckets. One is, there is what you know, what we know. The stuff that we know. So we can all identify that for ourselves. We know how to brush our teeth. We know how to drive to the grocery store. We know how to do whatever our profession might be. We know how to cook a meal. There's the stuff that we know. There is another slice, which is what we know we don't know. So there are a lot of things that I know that I don't know. I don't know how to play any musical instrument. I don't know how to be an artist. I don't know how to do a lot of mathematical calculations that some of our guests tonight will be, that they can do. But for most of us, this is the whole world. For most human beings, this is the whole world. There's the stuff that I know, and then there's the other stuff that I see and I'm aware of, but I really don't know much about it. The interesting thing is that there is a third category, which is what we don't know, we don't know. And this category is infinitely larger than the first two. There are all of these things, and we will go into these tonight, about God and about nature and about ourselves, that are so outside of us, so outside of our knowledge and cognition, that we don't even know that we don't know them. This is where mystery lies. And we're going to take a look at how to approach this, which begins to expand these other two slices of the pie of what we know, or at least what we know we don't know. So our first movement, and the largest of the three, is looking at this with respect to God. So God is, what is God? How are all of the ways that we could answer this question? So there is a formula which our friend of the Church of Conscious Harmony, Wayne Teasdale, gave us in a talk that he gave some years ago. And also, that was based on the philosophy of Spinoza, who's a 17th century theologian and philosopher and troublemaker. And in the 17th century, there was a very well-defined doctrine about what God was. And if you didn't agree with that, or if you spoke outside of that doctrine, you got into trouble. So along comes Spinoza, and he says, well, God is actually, he used the term substance, with an infinite number of attributes, with an infinite number of expressions. So Wayne unpacked this for us a bit. So when we think about the things that we know, or that we think that we know about God, we say, well, God is loving and God is merciful and God is forgiving, and these are the things that we say about God. And what Wayne and Spinoza are offering to us is that there are three categories of attributes that form our entire mental model of everything, not just God, but everything. And the attributes that we are able to grasp as human beings because of the hardware and software that we have in our bodies, minds, are being able to perceive material manifestation, consciousness, and love, which kind of maps onto the three centers that the work says that we have, the moving center, the intellectual center, and the emotional center. So material manifestation, that's everything, folks, that we can see or that we can measure. This is everything in the universe. It is physicality, it is heat, it is electromagnetic radiation. It's everything from atoms and quarks to stars and galaxies and universes. We live in a world of material manifestation, and it's hard for us to conceive of anything outside of that. We are also given, as part of the makeup of human beings, this thing called consciousness. We're able to think about things, to reflect on things, to form concepts about things, to reflect on ourselves and our own being. So there is some relational notion to this ability to have awareness of conscious awareness of the materiality that is around us, and love, the fundamental relational quality or attribute in this case that we say is what God is. So when we start thinking about everything that we can imagine in our world and our families and our jobs and you name it, in the grocery store, it's composed of these three attributes. And what Spinoza and Wayne were saying were, is that we don't have the ability to imagine anything outside of this framework. That this these are the eyes through which we can see and think and relate to everything else. These are big buckets. These are really big things. Think about all of the material manifestation, what consciousness can do. These are huge. And the hugeness of each of these is represented by the infinite expressions, which is why we have infinity to the infinite. So material manifestation, yes, there's an infinite number of expressions of those, from puppy dogs to quarks. Infinite expressions of consciousness, infinite expressions of love and gradations from great amounts of love expressed, self-sacrificing love, to at the other end of the spectrum, really the absence of love, or almost complete absence of love, which manifests differently on our planet. So they're saying that these are these three things that form our world, but that God not only has these three attributes, but has an infinite number of attributes, most of which we have absolutely no ability to access, no ability to even approach, because human beings don't have the capacity to operate in these other realms. God is big, and God is much, much bigger than anything that we might think God is. So these three things are the matrix of our universe, and those form that first slice, what we know. And then there is this big part of that model, what we don't know that we don't know, which with regard to God is infinitely large. You know, Billy was talking about the notion of a personal God and the difficulty with that. And one of the things that we're going to talk about God's revelations in a bit, and how God reveals God's self to us. But the only way that God can reveal itself to us is in the modes and in the language and in the concepts that we can grasp. If God revealed itself to us in one of these other attributes that we don't even have the ability to grasp, it would go right through us. It's like right now, we're all sitting here, we're hearing audio, we're seeing visible video, and at the same time, there are all kinds of electromagnetic things passing right through us. We have no awareness of it, and we can't have any awareness of it given the tools that we have in our bodies. We have AM radio that is going through us. We have shortwave. We have, you know, FM radio. We have over-the-air television. We have neutrinos that are, you know, passing through us. All of this is going on, but we don't have the ability to grasp or relate to it. Now, all of those are material, I understand. But then imagine that there are other things that are not material also coexisting with us, passing through us, but we don't have the way to grasp those things, to think about those things. This is true of God, which has these infinite attributes. So if God is going to reveal itself to us, it has to use things that would be natural or common to us. It needs to speak to us in our own language. And that's where personhood comes in. Right. We don't even have the capacity to imagine most of this stuff. So what can we say of God? Well, I went back looking through our friends throughout history, the mystics, and there is an interesting theme when you start listening to what the mystics had to say. Fourth century, Saint Gregory. We cannot rightly speak of God at all. Again, in the fourth century, from the author of The Cloud of Unknowing, thought cannot comprehend God. Sixth century, Pseudo Dionysius. All those who want to make statements about God are wrong, for they fail to say anything about him. Those who want to say nothing about him are right, for no word can express God. And at that, I should probably just shut up and say goodnight. St. John of the Cross, 10 centuries later, there are many attributes of God that we know nothing about. We have no concept or experience of. We don't have any evidence that John of the Cross knew of Spinoza's writings, but they were contemporaries, so perhaps he and Spinoza were on the same wavelength about this. Contemporary be Griffiths, all concepts of God are utterly ludicrous. Thomas Merton, all concepts about gods are raids on the unutterable, the unspeakable, the unreachable. And back to our friend Wayne, we can't even reflect on the other attributes of God. So this notion of God being unknowable or living in the holy unknowing has a very long history, very long trajectory to this stream of thought. Meanwhile, we've had the theologians who have been very, very, very busy in the realm of what we know. That thin slice of the circle, the little brown slice here. Not only the theologians, but also authors, people reflecting on what they know or what they believe about God. I went on Amazon.com, filtered for books, typed in the word God for the search criteria, and it said it had over 10,000 hits. 10,000 books about God. People have a lot to say about that very small slice of what we think we know about God. What I'm particularly interested in is the big part of the pie. So Wayne says, all of this sets the horizon on the possibility of our mystical knowledge, all of our knowledge. It says to us, guess what? You're never going to figure it out. Therefore, what is the attitude one acquires? It's one of humility. We should have courses in humility. And this is why humility is such an important attribute that we hear from spiritual teachers again and again. Humility is not only opening us, admitting that we don't know everything, or that what we think we know could be in error or just part of the story, but it opens us to the mystery. So here we have this knowledge of God, the very tiny slice of all that is possible is what we know. We have a model from Bernadette Roberts, and she explained how it is that we know what we know about God. This is in a weekend, or there's a whole workshop that she does on the essence of Christian mysticism. And she said that divine revelation, that what we know of God comes through divine revelation. And that, imagine if you will, there is some wall or something between God and us. That on the one hand, on the one side, God is revealing God's self as God is. And on the other side, we, through a pinhole, perceive something of that revelation. Now, whatever it is that we receive suddenly becomes filtered by the fact that we're humans and are the era in which this information is received, the culture, the teachings of the time, but that gets turned into our notions of God. So God, for lack of any better term, says I am, or maybe just says Om. And on our side, there is some mystical experience. Somebody receives something. Something of the unknowable leaks through, and there's this mystical experience. So Bernadette said there were a handful of divine revelations that were really seminal in the history of humankind. And the first is that people perceived God in all, showing up as God in nature, but God in all things. It's true, we think. It's part of our belief. Part of what we think that we know about God, that God is in all. That God is one. So Bernadette said that each of these revelations was a correction to human error that got tacked onto the first one. So God in all, one of the things that resulted in was nature mysticism, but then people had, and this is in the early days of Judaism and before, then we had the rock god and the sky god and the river god and the sun god and the animal god. There was this proliferation of gods. So at the time of Moses, there was a burning bush. And in Deuteronomy, when Moses is telling the Israelites what God said to him, one of them was the Shema, which is the beginning of a prayer that is the beginning of the morning prayers for people in the Jewish faith. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. So this is this correction that no, there's not this proliferation of gods, but that God, that there is singularity in God. And then we had, but we were still dealing with God as the judge, mostly through the Judaic revelation. And we have a new revelation that comes through the incarnation of Jesus, which is demonstrating a few things. One is God as love, rather than being judge, that God is loving, forgiving, merciful, patient, right? We know these attributes from Corinthians, that there is a notion of, there are attributes of this love, which are total and self-sacrificing and relational. And lastly, God as divine indwelling. So it's how Marianne began the class with the God as the transcendent, the immanent, and the omnipresent and the immanent, the holy indwelling nature of God. Bernadette said something that stuck with me. She said, Jesus didn't come to reveal himself to us. He came to reveal ourselves to us. And the ourselves that was being revealed was not, was the divine indwelling. Because God was still held to be God outside of ourselves, the God out there. And the message of Jesus was known. A message of unity of love and a unity of being one with God. We'll dive a little bit more into that next week. So this revelation, people got a hold of these things and they turned them into religions, turned them into dogmas, turn them into theologies, turn them into belief systems, turn them into arguments, turn them into persecution, turn them into holy wars, turn them into the Crusades, turn them into dualism, turn them into things that were very narrow, a lot less than the mystery of infinity to the infinity. That seems to be one of the things that people do, at least at this stage of consciousness, but I have hope for the future. And Paul spoke about this in scripture when he said of humility and wonder, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as also I am known." So understanding that whatever we think we know about God is just the tip of the iceberg. It's just the beginning of the story. But that there is some point in each of our divine journeys where we come into union and unity with that which is, and then we know things as they are, not as they have been given us. Okay, that was a lot. I've sprinkled a few poems in here just to give the other side of our brain a chance to breathe. So this is one of those moments. This is a poem from Mary Oliver. I looked up. I looked up, and there it was. Among the green branches of the pitch pines, thick bird. A ruffle of fire trailing over the shoulders and down the back. Color of copper, iron, bronze, lighting up the dark branches of the pine. What misery to be afraid of death. What wretchedness to believe only in what can be proven. When I made a little sound, it looked at me. Then it looked past me. And then it rose, the wings enormous and opulent. And as I said, wreathed in fire. What wretchedness to believe only in what can be proven. What wretchedness to be limited by the thin little green slice of what I call what I know. And then the last part of this poem expressed something about my relationship with God, which is just my relationship with God. It's not every, we all have our different ones. But when I make a little sound, it looked at me and then looked past me and then spread its wings and took off. That's my relationship with God. So take a breath. Let's all remember that we have a body. And we'll take a little path through the universe. Here it is. 46 billion light years across. We can't even imagine what that means. I can't. And I had enough hours in astronomy to be a double major. This is familiar territory and keenly interesting to me, and it is just mind-boggling. So like we had a brief history of God, we have a brief history of notions about the universe. 2,000 years ago, what did we think the stars were? Depending on where you went, people thought they were the souls of warriors. And the brighter the star represented how successful the warrior had been in battle. Others thought that the stars were golden nails and nail heads holding up the ceiling of the universe. Others thought they were lamps suspended by strings held by angels, and the angels lit them at dusk and blew them out at dawn. And they've been the source of myth and legend. All of the Greek mythology, Roman mythology is rooted in stars and constellations. And that lasted until the 1550s. In the 1550s, so this is just 500 years ago, which is nothing in the span of time. People still believed that the universe revolved around the earth. And if you spoke differently, you got into big trouble. In the 1600s, our friend Bruno was burned at the stake because he was suggesting that other solar systems existed. And in the same century, Galileo was convicted of heresy for heliocentrism, which was saying that the earth was not this, that things were not revolving around the earth, but rather that the earth moved. Galileo remained in house arrest for the next almost 400 years. It wasn't until 1923, when my parents were alive, that we knew that other galaxies exist. So this is modern understanding. In 1995, not that long ago, friends, there was something called the Hubble Deep Field Experiment. There was an astronomer, I think his name was Bob Miller. And he wrote a proposal. To get time on the Hubble telescope, you have to write a proposal. Scientists have to vet these proposals. And he wrote this proposal that Hubble be focused for 100 hours on nothing, on the blackest, darkest part of the sky where we could not know it, where we didn't think there was anything. Most astronomers thought that this was an enormous waste of very valuable telescope time. They thought it was a lousy idea, but his proposal got accepted. And they did just that. They pointed Hubble at the darkest part of the sky that was known. And as the photons began coming in, over the hours and hours and hours and hours, the image that you see on the screen here is what emerged. And everybody realized this was maybe one of the most important Hubble discoveries that we could know, which is that what we think of nothing was full, overflowingly full of more stuff. This was, at the time, what we didn't know, we didn't know. And through some relationship with that, which is, well, let's sit with what we don't know, we don't know, and open ourselves to it, suddenly something became known. And kind of going back to the relationship with God, and Grady's, again, bringing us the cloud of unknowing or centering prayer. What we're doing when we sit in prayer, in silent prayer, is we are sitting, opening ourselves to the vast unknown God, to the unknowable, and creating some kind of relationship with that that is transcendent of the senses that we have of materiality and consciousness. So pointing at nothing can be a very fruitful activity, spiritually and scientifically. Christmas morning, 2 years ago, I was up watching this The James Webb Space Telescope launched. The newest thing. So, if you don't know, James Webb is at one of the Lagrange points on the other side of, well, that's a whole different. Anyway, it's an amazing telescope. It is seeing things that are invisible to Hubble. A couple of months ago, the James Webb data led to questioning what is called the standard model of Big Bang cosmology. So we had what we thought we knew about cosmology and the Big Bang. We thought we had something about cosmology and the origins of the universe nailed down into that little green slice of the pie. Guess what? It's great. We create an instrument. It's able to point into nothingness or into somethingness. It's pointing into the what we don't know, we don't know. And what it's done is it has blown up, or it is in the process of blowing up what we know. Remember that lesson about humility. It's like, oh, so we get to deconstruct what we know so that we can know something new and different, bigger, perhaps closer to the truth. There was an astronomer almost 100 years ago who said the God that dwells in the temple of astronomy is a God who has created not only our own universe, whose immensity we cannot grasp, but millions of such universes, and has set them all spinning with perfect harmony through everlasting time and space. So this was, what, 8 years after somebody actually discovered that other galaxies exist. And she, this was a she, was intuiting that other universes exist. And now it's unproven, but it falls into the what we know, we don't know. Amazing. So what? So why am I talking about this? Here we are at the beginning of the Journey School. This is our relationship with God and everything. And it's so returning to this model here is that increasing knowledge doesn't decrease mystery. And this is one of the things that has been a, it's tough. It's been a tough thing for the church. It's been a tough thing for the theologians who have wanted over the millennia to hang on to dogma and not open themselves to new learnings and understandings, many of which are coming from science. So those of you who know the work of Ilia Dilio, I mean, she's a forerunning thinker in this area, trying to take the humility and creative thinking that is coming from the world of science and the universe, and using that to expand our thinking and understanding of and potential relationship with this thing that we call God. So increasing knowledge doesn't decrease the mystery. I mean, it's the world of science, every time we learn something, it just opens up more questions. The mystery keeps growing, and I think it's because the mystery is infinite. And what a lovely thing. What a lovely thing. There is always going to be more for us to move into and grow into and reach into and stretch into. And the day when I say I know and I stop that process is the day that I'm dead. So all of this brings us back to humility. This is a little image that the James Webb Space Telescope has given us. I can't even pronounce the name of this cloud complex. But when I look at it, I see an angel. I know why the shepherds fell on their knees on that, oh, holy night. So not only what we know and what we know that we don't know is important, but also how we see things is important. So it's time to switch to the other half of our brain now, friends. Another poem by Mary Oliver, Mindful. Every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It was what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the oceans shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. If you're not familiar with Mary Oliver, she's a poet, and she has books and books and books and books of the most sublime poetry rooted in the walks that she takes every morning in the woods, in marshes, her relationship with her dogs, and other miraculous things. And what she's pointing to here is that we develop this encrusted relationship with the world where we know it. And it's what the mind does. It's what our consciousness does. We perceive it and we know it. And what this is inviting us into is an unknowing relationship with materiality. Because this unknowing, it's exercising a muscle of unknowing can open up very interesting mysteries to us. The last part of our journey tonight is ourselves. Another quote of Socrates, for I was conscious that I knew practically nothing. It's good to know. So over the doorway of the Temple of Delphi, there's an inscription that says, know thyself. This is quoted in the commentaries a handful of times by Maurice Nicol. And humankind has been working with models to know itself for thousands of years. 5,000 years is the earliest recorded, which is astrology. It's a way, it's a model for understanding ourselves and knowing ourselves. But this goes on and on now. So as we start moving through history, the Buddhists 2,500 years ago or earlier were developing a very sophisticated catalog of afflictive emotions and suffering and the remedies for these things, cataloging what's going on in our emotional selves. In the past 100 years, so this is all, I mean, so it's coming on fast and hard nowadays. We've had the rise of psychology with Freud and Jung and all of the others. And then all of the ways that we measure and label ourselves, the Myers-Briggs, we all There's the Enneagram. There are dozens of typing systems that we love to type ourselves by, right? We have the energy centers as a way of looking at ourselves that Thomas Keating has brought to us very clearly. We have models of false self and true self and what is in these things. We have models that the work has given us, what our chief feature is. The work has taught us again and again and again and again, 5 volumes worth about self-observation, how to look at ourselves, how to understand ourselves, how to unpack ourselves, how to know thyself. And we have Hawkins' models of the levels of consciousness. So each one of these things could be a weekend workshop and is for different people. So we're just saying that there are all of these different ways of saying, who am I? And human beings, self-reflective human beings, are incredibly interested in who I am, who we are. Maybe that's the wrong question, though. This gets us so far, but it's just filling up that green slot of what we know about ourselves, and maybe filling in a little bit about what we know we don't know. Like, I don't know. Let's see, what you know you don't know. I know I get angry when somebody does this. I don't know why. So psychology helps us move stuff from that red slot over into the green slot. That's what it is. It's not helping to open us up into a more vast understanding of who we are as a being. It's just unpacking a little piece of us called our psychology. In life, in our culture, it's all about what we know. We're trained, we're rewarded for what we know. We're paid for what we know. People appreciate us for what we know. When we stop being so good at what we know, society values us less. But I think that maybe in God, it's all about who we are, not what we know. In Hawkins' model of the levels of consciousness, it's a logarithmic scale that goes from 0 to 1,000. And what he teaches us is that knowledge gets us to 499. The intellect gets us to 499, and that there are many people who have been the greatest intellects of the last century, but their calibration, it's like they hit a wall. These are the Einsteins of the world. And he says it's because something besides knowledge is required to move beyond this level of consciousness into a more relational and transcendent level. Another slice of a poem from Mary Oliver. The poem is called What Is There Beyond Knowing? What I know I could put into a pack as if it were bread and cheese and carry it on one shoulder. Important and honorable, but so small, while everything else continues unexplained and unexplainable. So here we are. The topic tonight is knowledge and mystery, right? So we've talked a lot about knowledge, but then there's the mystery beyond knowledge, which is this verdant, creative space to come into relationship with, this letting go into the mystery of what I am, what you are. So, coming back to the cloud of unknowing, the author says, no one can fully comprehend the uncreated God with knowledge, but each one in a different way can grasp God fully through love. Truly, this is the unending miracle of love, that one loving person through their love can embrace God, whose being fills and transcends the entire creation. So I prefer to abandon all that I know, choosing rather to love God, whom I cannot know. So these stages are inviting us to step into a relationship with the unknown. And there are many paths to this. There are many approaches to this through nature, through ourselves, through the universe, through the silence. But opening ourselves to something new. So here we are, this world of holy unknowing, this year that we are embarking on. So for me, the holy unknowing is that infinity part of what we don't know, and how we can move into that. At the end of tonight's or today's email, there was a suggestion or an offering to read a commentary on unknowing starting on page 1753. This is right before Nicol died. This is the third to last commentary in volume 5. If you stop sharing here. If you have the commentaries printed, that's great. If you don't, you can find PDFs online. But just to begin, actually, I opened it up. There are some slips of paper in here. Wrong ones. Anyway, here's the beginning of that commentary on unknowing. Because those of you who are who love to work might say, are you saying that knowledge isn't useful? No, not at all. Knowledge is very useful for getting us to a certain point. And then there's a different tool that is useful for getting us beyond that. Here's Maurice Nicol on unknowing. I would like to say to you tonight that all knowledge in the work is connected with unknowing. I suppose that many of you think that you know. This is our usual state. You all think you know what is right and wrong. You all probably think you know all about your particular jobs. You all think you know the right people, and so he goes on and on and on. To imagine that one knows anything is in the nature of an illusion. So another way of engaging with this topic of the unknown this week is to pick up that commentary in volume 5, because Nicol is giving us a lot of little exercises in the commentary, asking us to look at this, what we think we know about this, what we think we know about that, and to question that, and to see what happens when we question that. So I would say that the reference to that commentary is more than a suggestion. It's a wonderful avenue for self-expression, for self exploration. So that's all I got.
Thank you, Michael. How awesome, our God, you, creation. How wonderful. Let us just take that in and breathe for a moment the goodness that we have been given. So I'd like to close our time with another quote from Maurice Nicol, another commentary, an invitation. A few conscious people can produce more energy of high quality than thousands or even millions of people who exist automatically in sleep. But it doesn't occur as a result of a single moment of self-abandonment, rather as a repeated choice to respond to the impulses that reach one from one's own higher nature, of which one is not usually fully conscious. So we join together in affirming and praying wherever we are, the prayer of God's love, that God's love is always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully. And how blessed I am to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and to sleep, rest in Christ's peace. Amen.